This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future.
Today we have with us
Alison Milton,
John Moore,
Mike Lawrence,
Anne Weir,
and Stuart Burks.
And I'm Vicky Marie Buchanan. Today we are talking about food. We are sitting around a table and we've got a delicious morning tea in front of us, and it's got us all thinking, rolling back the years and thinking about favourite food and over the years, really. So we kicked it off with Sunday lunch, didn't we? And we're talking about roasts and how we had roast dinners. Do people want to talk about that?
As a family, we had a roast every Sunday. Mm-hmm. My grandparents came as well. And in those days, shops weren't open on Saturdays, so the meat was delivered on the Friday afternoon. And along with a pint of ice cream, which we were going to have for dessert. The roast dinner was obviously a roast of beef, roast potatoes and Yorkshire pudding, followed by a dessert. Now, it alternated ice cream every week, but my grandmother would make fruit salad 1 week, followed by apricot tart with homemade apricot jam following week.
Oh, yum.
And that was every Sunday was our lunch.
So did you have a fridge to put the meat in?
Yes, we did have a fridge.
Okay.
Yes. We probably had a fridge reasonably early, I think. We at the beach we had a safe, but we did have a small refrigerator.
Because that's right, there was
a little ice box where the ice cream was
kept.
Yes,
yeah.
Okay, so because some of the old houses, the idea of a safe, it was just an enclosed space with a sort of mesh on one side, so it was just fresh air on the shaded side of the house or something.
Yeah. My grandparents had that. They had a farm in Sandon Road Fielding, and my earliest memories were as kiddies we used to go there and always on a Sunday have a roast as well. And they didn't have a fridge initially, and that's everything went in the safe. Mm. And that's right, it sort of jutted out.
Yeah.
And it must have been on the cool side of the house, actually.
So how well did things keep in there?
Yeah. Well, not very well. You ate it before it went off, I think.
Yeah. It kept the flies out.
Yeah.
Probably one of the most important features of it. Mm. That was the mesh let the air through, but also kept the flies out.
There was nothing any better, so.
You wouldn't put them in a waterproof container in a stream or something to keep them cool.
Not many people had streams.
No, that's true.
No.
I think, was it hunters say you hang the meat, if you hang the meat high enough, then the flies won't catch.
Well, as a child, and going to my cousins, they'd killed the sheep or the animals that they were using, and you'd go into the barns, and there they were hanging days, really.
They had to hang to mature. You didn't need meat straight away. It had to be hung.
Yeah.
And back in the day, they used to bury the meat in the ground, I think. Right back.
All right. And this is all showing that in those days, you got some idea of where your food came from and so on. Because I remember this was in England, but my mother, if she got a chicken to roast, she'd take it home, and normally I think it would be plucked, but she'd open it up and she'd take all the giblets out and say, oh, this is the heart, this is the stomach, let's look inside, see what they've been eating and things like that.
Roast chicken was a novelty.
Chicken was special occasions.
Yes.
Very much.
Yeah, we had that too. What about you guys? Did you find that in your roasts?
Chicken was a rare thing.
Chicken was rare. What about you,
Mike? Did not often have chicken.
No.
I don't know whether we called it chicken in those days, because in those days chickens were little birds. I think we called them chooks.
That's right.
But these days you talk about fully grown hens as being chickens.
Now I think there's a distinction. You know, they're grown for meat or for eggs.
Mm.
But the interesting thing I found, because in England we did, you could get a reasonable sized chicken, and probably there were really hens, because I remember, well, even if they're grown for meat, the way they were done then took longer.
Because
In fact, I spent one time when I was travelling at one stage, I spent a few months working on a chicken farm, raising chickens for meat. And they were ready from, you know, from a day old to within 2 or 3 months, they were ready for the market. Whereas when I was young, they'd say, with chicken, do you want the red or the white meat, the dark or the light meat? And the legs would be, they'd be dark.
Yeah.
And the breast would be light, because the leg muscles had been used.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas now it's the same colour, and they've used hormones, I think.
Yeah.
It's not to get them to grow fast, it's to stop the infection so that they will grow faster. Mm. But they put
And if you had a chook that was past its laying by days, before you roasted it, you boiled it.
Yes.
So it was simmered until it was cooked, and then it was roasted to give it the...
You can buy those if you go... Well, the Mad Butcher stores, they have... they call them table hens.
Uh-huh.
And these are the X layers, I think. But those... And I cook them in my, you know, electric pressure cooker, instant pot sort of thing. So it comes out really tender, but it does have so much more flavour than a straight chicken, and it's more like chickens used to be.
That
taste.
Nowadays, I think the organic ones, they have a lot of flavour, but they're so expensive. They were expensive when I was looking at them years ago. I hate to think what they are now.
And I can remember that they were basically... I don't think they had the variety of sizes. I think you got a size.
Well, this is an interesting thing.
That at one point was available, a particular line came out, and it was really put into the special occasion market. It was called a Grand Poulet.
Oh, the extra large.
Little ones.
No, Grand Poulet.
Oh, yeah.
Big.
Yes,
And I remember my sister had a French student, probably early high school student, staying with them. And he came into the kitchen up the lake, and Mum was about to prepare this food for the... And he said, Poulet. And Mum said, no, Grand Poulet.
Very big.
It's interesting that New Zealanders have never really gone into turkeys or ducks, have they, for meals?
No, or only deer. Christmas, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the turkey, in England it was turkey or goose, and we'd always have goose. Because I think the turkeys tended to be fairly dry. In fact, goose was still drier than chicken. It may be how you cook it.
Yeah.
But I found, even like you were saying, with now there's this range of sizes. But the interesting thing, we get the frozen chickens, they used to have the neck and one or two other things inside. Now there's nothing. But also the sizes are almost to the gram. They say this is it.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you find, if you buy meat and then start cooking it, the amount of water that comes out, I think, you know, they use water to get the weight to just what it should, because they're not going to raise chickens to be exactly the weight they want. And they wouldn't know until after.
Traditionally, turkeys were always brined before you cooked them anyway.
Yes.
And so, to give them the extra flavour and to make sure that they are moist. The principle of brining meat will, of course, give it extra water in the weight as well.
Annabelle Langbein does that in her recipes when I've cooked roast turkey for Christmas.
Corned beef is the meat for having moisture. If you weigh a corned beef before you cook it and then cook it and weigh it afterwards, it's lost about a third of its weight.
Yes.
I'll tell you, you can get the sealed packs of corned beef that you then cut open and you put every... And if you read the label on it, it says something like contents meat 60%.
Oh, really?
That'd be right.
I came from a farm, so probably it was lucky for us. It was virtually food off the paddock, sheep, beef, eggs, milk, cream, everything. So for us, a roast dinner was frequent. But Sunday roast was really special, because my grandmother and her sister, who lived with her, they'd pick us up, we three children, to go to Sunday school, and our grandfather, my maternal grandfather, cooked the roast. And boy, was it fabulous.
Yeah.
And if we were late, he'd be out on the road with the oven cloth, looking. Where were we? The dinner is ready. But it was the best roast.
That timing issue is something that I recall, because my wife was Chinese, and so my parents-in-law, obviously China, they came to stay. And with Chinese food, the whole idea of a meal, whereas for European, you might have the, in the evening, you might have the meal, finish, and you know, it's all got to be hot and on the table. You eat it while it's still hot, then you have you do it, finish, and you might sit, drink, or whatever. Whereas with the Chinese, you graze right through until midnight or whatever, right. And the food's fine. But the idea of having to get everything ready at the same time, all the vegetables, meat, and everything, and all on the table, and then people should be there to sit and eat before it gets cold. They didn't have a kind of, it struck me how we are quite rigid in that structure, or were for those sorts of dishes, which doesn't apply for some cultures. But it affects the nature of the eating as well.
Yes.
But I suppose what we're saying also is that we all had the family meal idea, the family sitting around the table, especially like you say on Sundays with the extended family, which has largely gone for... In many cases.
No? Our grace was, the Lord be praised, my belly's raised 6 inches above the table. And then we kids were allowed to get up, run around the house several times, come back and have some more.
We had a secret code in our family, where my mother would say, if we were having guests or there was... it was good, but we were running out of food on the table, and the seconds going round, my mother would say, "You girls don't want any more, do you?" Or she would say, "FHB, family hold back," so that then everybody else could have first dibs. What was going on?
My growing up days were the lads' meal on the weekend on Sunday. It was the rest of it was just sort of pick and grab stuff. The Sunday meal was during the war years and beyond. It was very hard to get a lot of the ingredients if you have a regular dinner. A lot of it was imported and just wasn't available. The other business of having the milk, I used to watch the milkman come at 4 in the morning. You'd hear him coming down the road. No, look out for him. He'd always have a little light at the back of the van, and he'd fill it. I could hear him. It was in a can. Yeah. And he'd ounce it out into a can, and they were always. The milk was always served out in darkness, never in daylight. Mm. And we were instructed to put it out of the sun, but immediately we got it. Mm. So my job was in the morning. Fetching the milk out of the little thing at the gate.
4 in the morning?
First thing in the morning. The sun, unfortunately, was just a little bit leeward to the milk's entrance, sideways. And we had a cloth hanging down the front of it to stop the sun. That destroyed the milk. And you always know that. And so I took it to the house and put it into the safe, which was just in here.
Yeah.
We were westerly inclined for that safe. The wind blew it through it all, it kept it cool. And as far as ever having the milk in the sun was put into our minds at primary school. The milk at central school was left out in an official cabinet, and that's where I learned all about the airing and all that. We would have milk boys who would go and clean the milk, and they were not allowed to leave the milk at any time in the sun.
In your younger days, was milk delivered to houses in bottles?
Not in the early days, it was in the billy.
Yes.
We had it in bottles. We still had the milkman coming around in the little van, but they were little bottles, and you'd have a little crate and you'd put little coupons in the bottles, and then the milkman knew that you'd have half a pint or a pint of milk.
That's right.
And of course, the original ones had the cardboard lids that you made pom poms out of, because the cardboard lid was round and it had a
a hole to go.
And so, yes, so you took two of those, made a perfect size to make a pom-pom.
Ah, that's right. Yes, I do remember that. Yeah.
Well, those deliveries didn't happen for us until the very early 50s. Yeah.
Yeah. We had milk at school. We drank milk. I remember that every morning we would... at school, that it would be delivered to the school gate and somebody would come and pick it up, but by the time school started and they picked it up in winter, it was always lovely and cold, and in summer it was warm.
No, they left it in the sun. It was crumbling.
Well, only until sort of 9 o'clock.
It doesn't matter, the sun not
yeah, yeah, that's, no, yeah, yeah, cool. The same in England, but, yeah. But it wouldn't have happened in Palmerston North, would it? But in England, certainly north of England, in winter, and you'd even see photos of it, the milk would, part of it would freeze and expand, the cream would come up through the top of the bottle, and you get birds coming in grabbing the cream.
All day.
So why did they give us milk? Because it was free, wasn't it? Why did they give us milk
healthy.
Every morning? Was it healthy?
Health reason, yeah. It was, in England it was,
it
yeah.
Was, and, to make sure it was to do with the fact that I think probably almost a poverty type issue. So if a child got half a pint of milk a day, mm-hmm, at least that they were getting some.
You've got to wonder if we could do that now.
Nowadays we give you lunch.
Well, there has been some.
Yes. School lunches.
Yeah, we are.
Well, and this, it was I grew up in England in the time of, they call them dinners then, although it was lunchtime, and dinner ladies, where there'd be a special kitchen where they cook the meals. And, there was the idea of, is it, not very nice, very healthy food. Is it not nice? Some of it we thought was really great, but it was actually useful. Various things. One, you give them a very healthy meal, balanced meal, and they did say that people who grew up through that period, even through rationing and so on, were among the healthiest because they were eating well. Once they stopped having the school dinners and you could buy things the way you can now, you go here in New Zealand, you go to a shop, you buy a fizzy drink and a pie or something.
The schools actually delivered, I don't remember when they stopped doing it, but they certainly were right up to the high school days for me, delivering apples and oranges.
They
were sort of alternated. But that was a thing usually in the afternoon for a snack.
Okay,
now 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
During primary school years, we used to go home midday for our dinner every day. So
Yeah, we were too.
Yeah.
I only lived with an hour or less than half an hour.
Yeah, but And for me, that actually stopped when Massey got the staff club because Dad could have his dinner out at work. And so, no need for us.
I think at some stage the idea came in that lunchtimes at school is a time for kids to socialise as well. We'd go to school with a tennis ball in our pocket and kick it around and everything. So you get the exercise mix rather than just the formal.
And the big thing about the school and balls are the shoes that children were not to wear to school. You saw a line of shoes. If anybody bought shoes, they had to leave them out in the hallway or somewhere. The reason is, out at playtime, it hurt the feet of the children who didn't come to school with shoes. You see, wartime was leather problems. It was all going to the army.
Yeah.
So the only ones that wore boots and shoes easily were the people that played the rugby on the field into school rugby. But when it came to playtime rugby, it was all done in bare feet. You were not allowed to play with shoes on.
Yeah, which had never happened in England, I think. Yeah, which is, your feet got toughened up here, whereas in England it never happened. In fact, thinking about it, the shoes actually constrain the growth of feet, so you're probably better off if you can cope with it adjusting to that.
We were bare feet all the time.
Yeah, I still am.
We were bare feet.
The worst thing for me to go to secondary school was I had to wear shoes. Yeah.
Yes.
Primary school,
yes.
I think it's really amusing. People look back now and see these photos of kids with bare feet. Oh, shock, horror. And I'm thinking,
those poor kids.
We didn't want to wear shoes.
Yeah. Well,
it's not a sign of poverty, it was a sign of preference.
Yeah. See, the same with my son. My kids growing up, a country school, same thing.
And I spent 2 years in Britain. I only took one pair of shoes. I couldn't buy any shoes over in Britain. Nothing was wide enough for my feet. And so I rode my bike everywhere, winter and summer, in bare feet, as I did here. Mm. I always had a little rubber things. I never used the metal things. Never. They would cut your feet. Mm. But I was so used to it, even in the 20s. Mm. I'd even ride to work. Mm. And I worked in a photo engraver and working in acid. The boss told me off. I couldn't work on concrete floor with acid splashing all over. I did. That was the time I had to change.
Yes.
We had
one pair of sandals for summer, one pair of kilty lace-ups for winter.
Yes.
End of story.
Yes. Yeah. That's what
I did work in England in the winter time, and I did take a pair of Sunday shoes with me. Not for church, but something that I could wear when I was going out at night. And I had to wear them to go to work. Mm. But both times, the only time I wore the shoes.
And now schools today are teaching kids how to grow vegetables. You know, we were all saying we got the vegetables and the fruit off the trees at home and the vegetables in the garden. And now schools are growing or having vegetable plots to teach students. Yeah. This is where it happens. This is how you do it. Right. Then we eat it, isn't it? Because students...
And that's working effectively, is it?
In some areas.
We've got near the community gardens as well, where people can have some. Yeah. And some are well-tended and others...
And it's good. Because I remember saying to... I'd say to my students, so where does the meat come from? They'd say the supermarket. You know, so they'd lost that understanding and that whole chain that actually... We're rich, we've had that experience and understand it, but these kids that have just sort of got up and today and they think, oh, the meat comes, or the milk comes from the supermarket, and so really important to take them back to those stages.
I had heard the comment made that people growing up on farms in the past, they were very self-sufficient. They just bought a little bit of stuff in.
Yeah.
So there was, hence the you have your meat and three veg or something regularly, and that was the basis of their meals, whereas people in towns could have been more diverse in their eating. Is that an accurate representation?
I think most of
my friends and things would have food for proper,
regular
meals.
The proper New Zealand meal is a roast and three veg.
It's probably cottage pie.
Yeah, okay. Back then it was.
So quite a lot of mince would have been necessary. Yes.
But it's basically you have a meat component and add on the separate veg components.
I don't think I knew anybody who was vegetarian growing up.
Someone I was talking to said they had good Polish friends when they were young, and so these friends were giving them a whole range of so they got used to far more cosmopolitan
salami
food. But was that I remember in England there was a term, I don't know how universal, but the idea of foreign mutt, because it's not our food.
We had a Danish influence in our family, so a lot of people from European countries were living in this area, I'm sure.
So you ate a lot of different food other than just the standard.
I think it happened slowly, really. I think I had a friend, I remember, Standard 4, Tierra Primary, and she was Dutch. And I would go, you know, she came to my house and I came into her house. And so I was introduced more then to the Dutch salamis and cheeses, I think, then. We couldn't afford those sorts of meats anyway.
I found coming here, though, some of them, they're not necessarily expensive if they're the normal food for the... The amount I came in 78, the amount to which food availability has grown. So even in the cafes and restaurants, but also in the shops, the ingredients that you couldn't get 50 years ago that are readily available all over now.
Yeah. We used to have Dutch friends, and they'd bring cheese.
Yes.
And I can remember sitting at the table, sort of 5 years old, and we called it stinky cheese. So they'd sit around drinking bolts and eating stinky cheese.
Yeah, well, we had the, I think blue cheese was something a bit different from the... your standard cheddar cheese or whatever, but, and then garlic as well was something that in England, I think we're a lot more used to it now. But at that time, though, because some of us, we go on holiday to France and so on, and we knew then, or at least, well, one, you would meet people, often sort of older men, with a very strong breath from having eaten raw garlic, and we were told, and it may or may not be true, that they weren't allowed in cinemas if they'd been eating garlic. So, but that led us to think, oh, garlic, there's something bad about it, whereas used in a, an appropriate way in dishes, it's very good.
I think the European influence too for you in England is probably quite strong, whereas I grew up, my dad didn't have a high salary and my mum was raising us as well, and so our budget was really, really tight. I remember many a time walking down, she'd give me 2 shillings or a florin, and I'd go down to the butcher's and ask for 2 shillings of gravy beef and then take it home, and she'd make it into a great big stew with carrots and things that had come from the family farm, the vegetables, and we'd eat that stew. It was called stew, but it was probably nowadays they'd call it a casserole. But we had stew and potatoes and things like that. So good, solid food, malt every morning to keep our immune up.
It probably was a stew because it was probably cooked on the top of the stove.
Yes.
Not in the oven. Casserole's in the oven, so it's on the top. So it's a stew.
The pressure cooker.
And rice was for rice pudding, not for...
Bread butter puddings as well.
What, milk puddings? Those were very common.
Yes.
We weren't. My mother was not allowed to cook milk puddings because my grandmother did, and my father said it's sloppy. She had 2 instructions when they got married: any food, but not milky puddings.
But they were very healthy and not loaded with sugar like so many of today's cakes and desserts.
I never had tapioca or any of sago.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.